Lord's Books by Carlos Kevin Blanton, and the title of the column this month is Lone Star Populism. In the late 19th century, a new movement fought and failed to empower everyday Texans, but we can see its DNA in the New Deal, the Great Society, Donald Trump, and Bernie Sanders. One evening in 1890, Sam Johnson, a lanky Confederate veteran with dark hair and a friendly demeanor, attended a meeting of the Gillespie County Farmers Alliance in Fredericksburg. The 51-year-old Alabama native and Alliance member who had been designated to speak that night discussed at length the national organization's detailed agenda for helping small farmers who were being hit hard as the agricultural sector experienced a wrenching depression. 13 decades before Bernie Sanders advocated free college and health care for all, and Donald Trump handed out generous farm bailouts, Johnson espoused federally guaranteed loans, a network of federally owned warehouses in which small farmers could store their crops for free, and the federal regulation of crop prices. 2 years later, Johnson ran for the Texas legislature on the Populist Party ticket against his son-in-law, Clarence Martin, a conservative Democrat. According to family lore that Johnson's grandson recalled many decades later, the two rode together to various political events where they'd engage in heated debate and then clamber back onto their horse-drawn buggy to head to the next event. Johnson didn't win that race, but if your Texan senses are tingling, it's because his son, Sam Ely Johnson Jr., was elected to the State House as a reform-oriented Democrat in 1904, and 4 years later fathered Lyndon Baines Johnson, the grandson who would relate that horse-drawn buggy story, and who, as president, enacted domestic programs that embraced his grandfather's legacy. What united these Johnson men politically was Texas populism, claims Texas Christian University history professor Greg Cantrell in his new big new book, The People's Revolt, Texas Populists and the Roots of American Liberalism, on Yale University Press, came out March 17th. There were populist parties and movements in other states during the late 19th century, yet none, Cantrell argues, had such far-reaching effects on modern liberalism. As political commentators mulled the meaning of the recent rise of different forms of populism in the U.S., Europe, and India, Cantrell's book offers a timely look at the movement's early roots. Cantrell defines modern liberalism as a coherent democratic ideology that seeks to empower citizens to restrain concentrated power, private and public entities that exercise destructive control over society and individuals. He suggests that all 20th century iterations of American political liberalism, the Progressive Era, the New Deal, the Great Society, Civil Rights Movement, and the healthcare and financial sector reforms of the Obama administration, owe a tremendous intellectual and moral debt to the Texas populists of the 1890s. Tying the legislative and civil protest aspects of 20th century American liberalism to the pugilistic ethos of an era of Texas history rife with guns, stolen ballots, violence might seem odd. Yet Cantrell pulls it off by marshaling a great deal of evidence for his argument. His affection for his subjects, be they eccentric hayseeds or scheming lawyers, is infectious. Populism was a national third-party movement that responded to the economic booms and busts of the Gilded Age when Americans grew angry about unbridled corruption, the rise of corporate power, immigration, and the widening gap between rich and poor. Sound familiar? It also had a strong Texas twang. Populism arose out of the National Farmers Alliance, which was founded in Lampasas County in 1877 and signed up tens of thousands of Texans by the 1890s. Many of the movement's national leaders, such as Charles W. McCune and Harry Tracy came from Texas, where the populist-oriented People's Party fought to protect homeowners from out-of-state banks, predatory loans, and foreclosure, measures that became law decades later after the populists had passed from the scene. As had happened so often in U.S. history, racial divisions made it difficult to organize along lines of class, gender, or ideology. Yet Cantrell writes, at a time when Jim Crow laws were on the rise, many Texas populists pushed back, promoting African Americans to positions of party leadership and putting together multiracial coalitions that elected dozens of state legislators in the early 1890s. Those legislators sponsored what Cantrell calls good government bills that would modernize government agencies, increase efficiency, lower costs, or curb corruption. A little sidebar here labeled Dig This, an exhibit by the Texas Disc Plow Company at an 1896 populist gathering in Collin County was described by one newspaper as by far the grandest display ever made by a plow company in this country. Okay, back to the text. Populists often demonstrated tremendous bravery at the local level. In 1894, amid increasingly dangerous racial tensions, Andrew Jackson Spradley, the populist sheriff of Nacogdoches County, summoned five African Americans to serve on a state district court jury. Spradley's motivations may have been political rather than moral, but promoting African Americans' interests for whatever reason could have gotten a white man, not to mention those five black potential jurors, killed in that place and time. In fact, Spradley was turned out of office weeks later. Fair warning, with some exceptions, Cantrell's populists are hard to dislike. Earnest, well-meaning, courageous, sympathetic to the less fortunate, and willing to do battle for their beliefs, many of them seem, in his telling, straight out of central casting, as plucky fighters punching above their weight and beyond their reach. In most cases, well beyond their reach. Populists are among the many losers of American political history. Parties are movements that couldn't survive the gravitational pull of the nation's two-party system, or, in Texas's case, the imperial rule of the Democratic Party, which was, in a sense, still fighting the Civil War. Texas Democrats in the 1890s, desperate to retain control of the state, could be relied on to commit voter fraud and use the vilest racism to spread terror and violence. And when this cheating and harassment didn't work, some tried sounding like populists. The most successful Texas governor of the late 19th century, competition was embarrassingly slim, was James Stephen Hogg, who in the early 1890s co-opted populist ideas with folksy speeches, all while advancing Jim Crow and committing voter fraud and suppression. Some 20th century historians who have written about populism have seen a reflection of their own times in that earlier era. In the 50s, the historian and public intellectual Richard Hofstadter regarded the populist as paranoid anti-electuals, a precursor to the McCarthyism then roiling the country. In 1977, Lawrence Goodwin won the National Book Award for Democratic Promise, the Populist Movement in America, which portrayed the Farmers Alliance as a forerunner to the counterculture of the 60s. Recent historians, like Charles Postel, characterized Alliance members as public policy visionaries who predicted much of the legislative agenda of the progressives, the New Dealers, the Great Society. Cantrell largely follows in Postel's interpretive path with a particular emphasis on the movement's Texas origins. This is giving the populace a tremendous amount of credit. Is it deserved? It is. Many of the movement's reform ideas, such as consumer protection laws, a graduated income tax, and agricultural subsidies, were enacted during the 20th century. At times, though, Cantrell is too protective of his populace. In particular, he downplays the fact many of them were, by any standard, racist. Take James Cyclone Davis, an organizer for the Texas People's Party who, Cantrell notes, later championed the Klan and resorted to racism, anti-Semitism, and anti-Catholicism to explain his political defeats and frustrations. While not all Texas populists were as racist as Davis, too many were. The populist gubernatorial candidate of 1894, Thomas Nugent, sought African-American votes while supporting racial segregation, believing it wise to remove this controversy about so-called and impossible social equality. This mindset applied to Tejanos as well. Many populists viewed the votes of Tejanos and Mexican immigrants in South Texas border communities as a threat to democracy. San Antonio populist Theodore J. McMinn legally challenged the right of people of Mexican origin to vote because, as Cantrell summarizes McMinn's argument, they were not white by any scientific or common understanding. Cantrell defensively argues that there is no evidence that McMinn's attempt to disenfranchise an entire population reflected blanket anti-immigration bigotry, even though McMinn was later repudiated by the Texas Populist Party. Rather, he writes, it reflected a desire to clean up political corruption. This elaborate knot-tying is unnecessary. Cantrell's argument that the populist's colorblind economic policies would have benefited African Americans, Tejanos, and poor whites is convincing enough to arrive at a more nuanced judgment. This caveat aside, the people's revolt will persuade most readers to forgive the populace their flaws, if not excuse them. And many will note the book's relevance to the political season of 2020. Commentators today often equate small p populism with demagoguery and use the term to describe both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, who represent anti-establishment insurgencies on the right and the left. Sorry. Sorry. This book rescues the word by telling us who the Texas populists really were and what part of their legacy still survives. The populists of the 1890s mostly lost the battles of their day, but their ideas lived on, shaping American politics to this day. Cantrell concludes, at a time when many of us feel subjugated by concentrated power, it's gratifying to be reminded that dogged people working together can fight to make their country better in ways to transcend momentary loss or defeat, even if those battles have to be fought again generations later. The populists teach us that the most important battles always do. The author of this piece is Carlos Kevin Blanton, and he's a professor of history at Texas A&M University in College Station. And we turn now to one of our feature articles. This is a little bit longer piece. It's entitled, A Year of Firsts by Skip Hollinsworth. Michelle Girard knew that her former student had lived a hard life. He'd never had a birthday party or celebrated Christmas. So when he was found wandering the streets alone, she immediately agreed to take him in. Then she decided to give him far more. And that's the article, A Year of Firsts. The call came into the Coryell County Sheriff's Department on the afternoon of June 4th, 2019. A young man had been seen walking aimlessly up and down a stretch of U.S. 84 a couple miles east of the central Texas town of Gatesville. He'd been there for at least 2 days, the caller said. He looked to be on the verge of collapse. A deputy named Billy Holder headed that way. He soon spotted the young man who was standing in the road. An 18-wheeler had to abruptly change lanes to avoid swiping him. Holder flipped on his squad car's emergency lights and parked in the middle of the highway to stop traffic. The young man waved at him. He was about 5'7" tall and painfully thin, maybe 110 pounds. His sweat-stained, blue-striped polo shirt was tucked into his faded blue jeans. He wore a gimme baseball cap and weathered tennis shoes. In one hand, he held a flashlight. In the other, an envelope. When Holder approached, the young man smiled and patted the officer's shoulder. Are you my buddy? He asked in a gentle sing-song voice. The 37-year-old Holder, who has worked for the Sheriff's Department for nearly a decade, could tell the young man was disoriented. He had no identification. He said his first name was Chris, but he couldn't remember his last name. When Holder asked why he was pacing the highway, he replied, My daddy's sick. My daddy can't walk. But no matter how many times Holder prodded, Chris couldn't remember where his home was. He again patted Holder on the shoulder. Holder asked about his mother, and Chris just shook his head. "Is there anyone you know here in Gatesville?" Holder asked. "Miss Gerard," he said. "I know Miss Gerard." Holder helped Chris into the squad car, gave him a bottle of water, and drove him to the sheriff's department. Chris sat in a chair in the lobby, murmuring to himself. At times, he put his head in his hands and rocked back and forth. A dispatcher at the department gave Holder the name of a woman who worked as a special needs aide at Gatesville High School. "We picked up someone who says his name is Chris," Holder explained to the aide. "He's African-American with short dark hair. Looks like he's in his mid to late 20s. I'm guessing he was one of your special needs students. Do you have any idea who he is?" She called a colleague from the high school, and together they went to the sheriff's department. "That's Chris Barrington," one of them said when they arrived. "No one has seen him in a long time." Holder said the young man had mentioned a Miss Gerard. "That's got to be Michelle Gerard," the other woman replied. She pulled out her cell phone and called her. At 59, Gerard was retired and living alone in a small house on 28th Street. She had been Chris's middle school teacher, though she hadn't seen him in nearly a decade. A bad hip made it difficult to walk or climb stairs, but when she got the call about Chris, she rose from her easy chair, reached for her crutches, and told her tiny dog Bella, a Yorkie Terrier mix, that she'd be right back. Gerard eased her way out of the house, settled into the driver's seat of her compact Honda Fit, made her way to the sheriff's department, and limped into the lobby. Chris lifted his head. "Miss Gerard," he explained. "My daddy is sick, Miss Gerard." She first met him in 1996, summer program for special needs kids at Gatesville Primary School. She was 36 at the time. He was 6. By then, Gerard had been teaching for 6 years. As a young woman, she had worked as a church secretary in Houston, but after meeting some children with autism, she says she, quote, "felt called to do what I could for them." She attended University of Mary Hardin Baylor in Belton, where she majored in special education. She taught special needs classes in nearby Copper's Cove for 2 years before landing a job in Gatesville. She was known as a patient teacher, rarely raising her voice. At the summer program, she was assigned to look after Chris, who had been diagnosed with autism. Earlier that year, Chris's mother had been killed in a car accident. Chris lived alone with his father, Billy Barrington, a machinist who ran a lathe. People who knew Billy said he was a quiet man, a loner. In his spare time, he tinkered with broken-down cars, pickup trucks, trailers, and motorcycles. Gerard took to Chris right away. "He made little eye contact with others, and he rarely interacted with other kids," she told me. "He bounced from one side of the room to another like an Energizer bunny. And then sometimes he would climb up in my lap, hungry for affection, telling me, 'My mommy's in heaven.' If you met him, you couldn't help but love him immediately. And I mean immediately." During the school year, Gerard taught special needs kids at Gatesville Junior High. In the fall of 2000, 11-year-old Chris entered her classroom. He wanted to sit right next to me, trying to complete spelling words and simple addition and subtraction problems, Gerard said. He had beautiful handwriting, and he loved to draw. For some reason, he especially loved drawing pictures of white doves, and he loved patting people on the shoulder. "One day, I slipped off a curb and tumbled to the ground, and he walked over and patted me on the shoulder and said, 'Miss Gerard, you fell down.'" Gerard could tell Chris's life at home wasn't easy. Although Chris's father, Billy, took him to school each morning and picked him up every afternoon, he only spoke to Gerard once a year when they met to discuss Chris's progress, and he didn't ask many questions. When she asked Chris what he and his father did after school, he told her that he sat in his room while his father worked. She asked if they celebrated Chris's birthday. "No," he said. "What about Thanksgiving or Christmas?" Gerard asked. "No," Chris said. "Did they ever go out to dinner at a restaurant?" "No," Chris said. They only ate canned food or frozen microwave dinners. Chris spent 4 years with Gerard at the middle school. When he was promoted to Gatesville High, he was still unable to read or do simple math. He had only one friend, a boy who suffered from severe muscular dystrophy, but that boy moved to Arkansas and later died from complications caused by the disease. At Gatesville High, the special needs teachers focused on basic life skills, grocery shopping, counting money, mailing letters, and preparing simple meals like spaghetti. Chris did his best, but even so, he struggled. He basically functioned on a six-year-old level, and in some areas, he functioned as a three-year-old, said Gerard, who periodically visited Chris at the high school. When he graduated in 2010, in Texas, students with disabilities can stay in public school until they reach age 21. Gerard and his other teachers worried that his father wouldn't be able to properly care for Chris. He was doing the best he could, said Gerard, but I wondered if he too suffered from his own form of autism. By then, Billy was in his late 70s, retired from his job as a machinist. He sold his Gatesville home and bought a secluded piece of property outside of town at the end of a dirt road just off U.S. 84. He filled the property with rusted out vehicles, trailers, engine parts, motors, bumpers, and tires. He built a makeshift two-bedroom house, most of it constructed from plywood, sheetrock, particle board, and metal siding. There was no air conditioning or central heating, just a couple of fans and space heaters. Electric wires dangled from the ceiling. The living room was crammed with broken computers, broken furniture, old tools, and stacks of paper, and the kitchen counter held cans of food and bug spray. Chris lived in nearly complete isolation. He never saw a doctor or dentist. He was never issued a government ID. He never visited a social services agency, and he never dropped by any of the Gatesville churches that hosted programs for adults with special needs. Not long after Chris's high school graduation, Gerard spotted him sitting inside his father's pickup in the parking lot of the local Walmart. Chris rolled down his window, a wide grin on his face. "Mr. Gerard," he said, "I'm waiting for my daddy. He wants me to stay here while he goes inside." Minutes later, Billy returned and reassured Gerard that he and his son were doing just fine. "Is there anything you need?" Gerard asked Billy. "Anything I can do for you?" "No, ma'am," said Billy. He got behind the wheel and drove away. It was the last time she'd see Chris for 8 years. Gerard continued teaching, but gradually her hip problem became debilitating. She also suffered a minor stroke. And so, in 2016, after more than two decades in the school district, she decided to retire. To supplement her meager pension, she occasionally worked as a substitute teacher. To stem her loneliness, she sat a couple times a week with an elderly woman who could no longer care for herself. When she was younger, Gerard had been engaged to be married, but the relationship hadn't worked out. She rarely saw her mother, brother, and sister, all of whom lived in other states. She had a handful of good friends, but she had made peace with the notion that, for the most part, she would spend the rest of her days alone. At the sheriff's office that day in June, as Gerard talked to Chris, Holder examined Chris's flashlight. The batteries were dead, in the envelope he'd been holding, an advertising mailer addressed to occupant. Holder and another deputy drove to the address printed on the envelope. Turning off U.S. 84 onto a dirt road, they pulled onto what they discovered was Billy Barrington's property. Holder glanced around at the piles of scrap, then stepped onto the porch and knocked on the front door. When no one answered, he walked inside, dodging several holes in the floor. He made his way past a disconnected toilet in the hallway. Inside one bedroom was a twin bed without sheets, just a thin blanket atop it, and a rickety dresser. On top of the dresser was a beat-up laptop with a few keys missing. Taped to the walls were illustrations of skyscrapers and birds that seemed to have been drawn by a child. When Holder entered the second bedroom, he found an old man curled in bed in the fetal position. It was Billy. His breath came in spurts and was barely able to move. Holder called for an ambulance and Billy was taken to a hospital. Holder returned to the sheriff's department and told Gerard about Billy's condition. A sheriff's official then walked up and said that they had no place to keep Chris. The official asked Gerard if she would take him in. "Of course I will," Gerard replied. On the way to her house, she stopped at Walmart and brought Chris inside with her. He looked around in wonder, awed at the size of the store. She helped him pick out clothes, pajamas, and toiletries. They then drove to a Chinese restaurant where Chris went through the buffet line 3 times. When they made it home, Gerard showed Chris the guest bedroom, which had clean sheets on the bed. It was late, so Chris pulled on his new pajamas and curled up in bed, but he couldn't sleep. He wandered into Gerard's room, sat on the edge of her bed, and said, "It's dark outside, Miss Gerard." Chris began talking about his life with his father, explaining how he spent a lot of time in his room drawing pictures and watching Disney movies on a portable DVD player. His favorite was Brother Bear. He said his father had taught him how to turn on the old laptop and use YouTube and Google Maps. He suddenly switched subjects. "Do you have a Christmas tree?" he asked. Gerard was surprised. It was June, after all. "I have one in the closet," she replied. "Will you put it up?" asked Chris. "Yes," she said. "Will you have presents?" "Absolutely." Then Chris repeated what he had told her several years back in junior high, that he had never celebrated Christmas at his home. Take a little break here and remind you that you're listening to Texas Monthly Magazine, Into Sound Broadcasting. This year marks over 50 years of enriching the lives of individuals with visual, physical, and perceptual disabilities. Listen to Sight Into Sound on one of our specially tuned radios, channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or mobile device, or listening at your convenience on our archives page. We are Sight Into Sound Radio since 1967. And I apologize, I'm recording this at home, so gotta help me out a little bit. Be patient. I appreciate that. Thank you. And now we're going to get back to our text. A few days later, doctors diagnosed Billy with late-stage leukemia, and he was transferred to a nursing home. When Chris and Gerard would visit, Chris dutifully sat by the bed and held his father's hand. Chris would ask Gerard if his father was going to heaven to be with his mommy. "I think he'll be there very soon," Gerard said. Chris also asked Gerard if he could continue living with her. "You can stay with me forever," she said. Chris last saw his father on July 31st, nearly 2 months after Chris was picked up on U.S. 84. Billy was unconscious by then. Chris patted his shoulder to comfort him, as he often did. He walked out into the hallway where Gerard was sitting. He climbed into her lap and sobbed. Billy died the following day. As word spread around Gatesville that Gerard had taken in Chris, her friends worried that caring for him would overwhelm her. Chris was always going to be a challenge, they said. He would be constantly needing her day and night. With her bad hip, how would she keep up? And on her limited income, how could she afford it? She'd gone through most of her savings a few years back on repairs after part of her home had caught fire. And instead of paying for Chris's food and clothes and visits to the doctor, shouldn't she be saving her money for much-needed hip replacement surgery? "I understood what they were saying," Gerard told me, "but I didn't want someday for God to say to me, 'I was thirsty, I was hungry, I was homeless, and you turned your back on me.' And you know, I'd always prayed for a child, and I'd always prayed for a family of my own. I realized this was God's way of answering my prayers." Because Chris had lived such an isolated life, Gerard was determined to make 2019 memorable for him. A year of firsts, she called it. For his 30th birthday on August 9th, she arranged a boat ride around Lake Waco. Chris, who told Gerard he had never been on a boat, was euphoric, squealing as the boat glided across the water. For Halloween, she went to Walmart and bought him a top hat and a t-shirt decorated with pumpkins. Chris trick-or-treated around the neighborhood, always making sure to say thank you to whoever gave him candy. Every Sunday, Gerard took Chris to Coryell Community Church, where he enthusiastically clapped along with the praise music. She entered him into the local Special Olympics program. At home, she taught Chris how to make a peanut butter sandwich, scramble eggs, put his dishes in the dishwasher, do his own laundry, sweep the floors, and make his bed, tasks he had struggled to pick up before. "You can do it, Chris," she said over and over whenever she taught him a new skill. "You can do it." And then, the day after Thanksgiving, which they celebrated at the home of one of Gerard's friends, Gerard pulled her Christmas tree from the closet. He assembled it in the living room and asked Chris to hang the ornaments. Thrilled, he spent several hours decorating the tree, making sure each ornament was perfectly placed on its branches. He even set up the nativity scene, Gerard told me, when I visited the week before Christmas. He was beaming. Somehow, he knew exactly where to put Mary and Joseph and the baby Jesus. He must have seen a nativity scene when he was a little boy and never forgot it. Chris was listening intently to our conversation, strolled over, patted me on the shoulder and said, "I like Christmas. Do you like Christmas?" Gerard admitted that she had gone a little over budget buying Christmas presents for Chris. He had become fascinated by the New York City skyline, often exploring Manhattan on his laptop using Google Maps. So she'd bought a 6-foot-tall cardboard cutout of the Statue of Liberty. She had also wrapped boxes of Paw Patrol characters, a basketball, matchbox cars, a couple sweaters, a sterling silver necklace, and drawing paper. Chris loves drawing pictures, everything from the Manhattan skyline to his favorite birds, white doves. "Oh well," she said, "think of what he's been through all these years. He deserves something good." When I first went to see Gerard at her home, she was deeply in debt. Hoping to gain legal guardianship of Chris, she had racked up close to $4,000 in attorney's fees. She had also agreed to pay Billy's hospital and nursing home bills, which added up to $13,000, and she had spent another $1,400 for Billy's cremation. After a version of this article was published on Christmas Eve on TexasMonthly.com, a reader set up a GoFundMe account for Gerard, and within 2 weeks, 198 people had donated more than $16,000. She received another $2,905 in contributions and gift cards in the mail. One woman sent $5, explaining it was all she could afford. "These days, you read the news and think there is far more bad than good," Gerard told me. "I'm here to tell you that there is a goodness to people you cannot imagine." The GoFundMe account has since surpassed its original goal of $20,000. Still, she knows the contributions will eventually come to an end, and then she's back to living on her teacher's pension. She also knows she needs to plan for Chris's future in case something happens to her. A couple of her friends have said they'd consider taking him in. If not, Chris will most likely end up in a state-run group home. "Hopefully, I've got at least 20 years left in me," said Gerard, "and I plan to enjoy every one of those days with Chris." During his short time with Gerard, Chris has grown both emotionally and intellectually. He recently built an 18-inch model of the Empire State Building with Legos. Not long ago, for the first time in his life, he went into a store by himself, a discount retailer called Five Below, and while Gerard waited in the parking lot, he used a gift card to buy a Star Wars t-shirt, a Spider-Man comic book, a banana keychain, and a toy action figure. And one night, Gerard drove Chris to a special needs prom in Waco. The theme was A Night to Shine. Chris wore a tuxedo and danced to every song. "He was so full of joy, I thought my heart would break," said Gerard. When I called her in February, she put me on speakerphone and told me Chris was finally letting her kiss him on the cheek. "That's another first," Gerard said. "I think he's been anxious about letting someone love him." I heard Chris's voice from the other side of the room. "Oh, I love Miss Gerard." "I know you do, my sweet Chris," Miss Gerard replied. He laughed. "I know you do." We turn back now to the state. This is a section called News and Politics by Christopher Hooks, called Dispatch. And this month's column is entitled, Is Climate Change Denial Thawing in Texas? Surprising statements by oil industry leaders have grabbed headlines, but the bigger change is underway more quietly among young Republicans. On January 10, 1901, Spindletop gushed forth near Beaumont, ushering in the age of oil. An unholy amount of money blanketed Texas, materializing in pocketbooks as if manifested by God. Then, 119 years and 4 days later, Todd Staples, as president of the Texas Oil and Gas Association, a trade organization for several thousand firms associated with the state's fossil fuel industries, got on the phone to take questions from the media about the group's periodic efforts to keep that money flowing, specifically its plans for the 2020 election. Things took an unexpected turn. A reporter pointed out that amid perms in 2018 saw a surge in young voters who are much more likely than older folks to say they want the government to take action on climate change. Did that concern TXOGA? Staples responded that the organization considered itself an ally of those voters. The oil and natural gas industry is absolutely committed to climate progress, he said, and we want to help get the message out that no one is investing more in low-carbon technology. Every voter needs to know that we share a common goal of a lower emissions future. It was a pretty milquetoast statement, but a remarkable one coming from Staples, a staunch Republican and former Texas Agriculture Commissioner. Staples spent his time in office, attacking proposals to address climate change and once urged the U.S. Department of Agriculture to fire all of its treasonous employees involved in promoting Meatless Monday, an international climate-conscious campaign to eat vegetarian once a week. In 2010, Staples joined Governor Rick Perry and Attorney General Greg Abbott to promote the state's lawsuit against the Obama-era Environmental Protection Agency as it attempted to curb the nation's carbon emissions, and all three sowed confusion about climate science in the process. The idea that limiting greenhouse gases would be good, which Staples was endorsing, implies that emissions are in some way bad or have negative consequences, a concession with sweeping implications for TXOGA members, not to mention the broader Texas economy. If emitting carbon at current levels is harmful, then it follows, even from a conservative perspective, that the state ought to curb carbon, at least when practical. Was the mouthpiece of Texas Oil calling indirectly for a crackdown on the flaring of natural gas or for limits on methane emissions from leaky pipelines? For an end to the massive state and federal subsidies for fossil fuels? Or even for electric cars, solar farms, and nuclear power? Was Staples playing the role of Mikhail Gorbachev, and was this his glasnost, or ahem, upon coming, gasnost? Ugh. Staples took another question. Did TXOGA agree that burning oil and gas contributed to climate change? Quotation. We believe that all emissions contribute to climate change, and we believe that our industry is committed to doing our part, unquote. Every emission, wood that's burned, there's carbon emissions from multiple sources, and to have a real conversation, we need to look at all sources, unquote. That suggestion that a family in, say, Burundi, with a wood-burning stove, is a co-equal culprit in the warming of the planet is an indication that Staples was not exactly channeling Greta Thunberg. But the timing was itself telling. He spoke at an unprecedented wildfires ravaged vast swaths of Australia, a leading exporter of coal, putting pressure on Australia's conservative prime minister to acknowledge the country's significant carbon output, even as he said he would protect the coal industry. In the United States, there are other signs of a thawing of hardline messaging on climate change, even during the rule of an administration steadfastly opposed to doing anything about the problem. American Petroleum Institute, the national counterpart to TXOGA, recently started referring more to the natural gas and oil industry instead of oil and gas, emphasizing the more climate-friendly fuel, at least if produced and transported appropriately. About a week after Staples' concession at an event hosted by the conservative Texas Public Policy Foundation, Texas Congressman Dan Crenshaw, a 36-year-old former Navy SEAL who has positioned himself as the face of millennial conservatism, introduced a small disturbance in the force by telling the audience that Republicans needed to start taking environmental issues, including climate change, seriously. Crenshaw noted that the environment regularly ranked as a top concern for Democrats, Republicans, and independents alike. We can make fun of the left's sort of alarmist views on climate change, and we should, to an extent, but we can't ignore it completely, he said, because they were, quote, not totally untrue. Crenshaw said the GOP should emphasize that climate change could be solved by, quote, innovation, research, and development, which is more politically palatable to voters than asking them to give up states and pickup trucks. Not a particularly radical sentiment. Crenshaw's suggestion is still to the right of virtually every major conservative party in the developed world, but again, you have to take into account the speaker and his audience. The Texas Public Policy Foundation has ties to fossil fuel interests, and in recent years has spent generously on a campaign to hobble the thriving Texas wind power industry while protecting the vast government subsidies flow to the oil, gas, and coal industries. Little sidebar here. Titled, What's in the Pipeline? The annual carbon footprint from new oil and gas facilities in Texas and other Gulf states could be as high as 541 million tons of greenhouse gases by 2030, the equivalent of 131 coal-fired power plants. All right, we return to the text. Around the same time that Crenshaw made his comments, Houston's elite business people gathered for the annual meeting of the Greater Houston Partnership in the powerful Houston Business Association at the heart of the oil-driven city. In almost any other context, Chair Bobby Tudor's message to the audience of oil and gas types would have been seen as an invocation of conventional wisdom, but here was brave, or at least bold. A consensus has emerged among scientists, business leaders, and the general public that climate change is a real problem that requires urgent attention from all of us, and that we therefore will be using less hydrocarbon-based energy sources, unquote. The industry was, quote, dramatically out of favor at the moment in most every corner of the investing and political world, he said, and it needed urgently to adapt. At its most basic level, I think we can all agree that having less CO2 emissions in the atmosphere would be a good thing. And as Houston's business leaders, we need to be committed to working to make that happen. For skeptics inclined to think that change in rhetoric was just a PR move, Staples, for one, was ready to oblige. 2 days after his call with reporters, he went on the public radio show, The Texas Standard, to clean up his spill. It seemed as if he had intended to signal a change in messaging, but was surprised by how seriously everyone had taken it. I think the term climate change has been hijacked. I think it's been used to, unfortunately, introduce climate hysteria or climate confusion. I think the term is used in such a way to confuse the public that the sky is falling in, he said. Much of the industry reacted to Staples' message and his subsequent walk back with a shrug, but some were angry. Unfortunately, many of these large companies feel the need to apologize rather than stepping up and talking about the dramatic impact cheap, reliable energy has made on our standard of living, said Kathy Shannon, the executive director of the Permian Basin Petroleum Museum in Midland. Right-wing advocacy organization Texas Scorecard accused Staples of jumping on the liberal bandwagon. One conservative blogger wrote that one can only assume that Staples is now a non-climate denier in order to reach future political heights, perhaps mollifying the left in advance of a new political run. He's prepping as a veto plone. Of course, there's something a little ridiculous about parsing statements from oil and gas trade groups at a time when Australia and the Amazon are burning. It's a kind of recurrent amnesia that paints climate change as a perennially new problem, an issue that is just reaching critical mass of awareness. It's shocking today to reflect on just how much we've known all along and how much we've decided to ignore. Since at least the early 1800s, scientists have been aware of the greenhouse gas effect. In 1856, scientist Eunice Foote established that carbon dioxide was remarkably efficient at trapping infrared heat like that from the sun, and theorized that a carbon-saturated atmosphere would spike the Earth's temperature. By the 1890s, in the years before Spindletop, researchers had moved on to the question of how fast carbon emissions would heat the Earth. And it's not as if this scientific knowledge was a secret either. In the 1950s, a short educational film directed by Frank Capra in a cheery mid-century style and screened at schools across the country showed a scientist predicting that thanks to the waste products of civilization, future tourists would possibly one day board glass-bottom boats to get a glimpse of the drowned towers of Miami. Political leaders were also aware of the problem. In the 1980s, politicians as conservative as George H.W. Bush and Margaret Thatcher warned of the urgent threat posed by climate change. As recently as 2008, the presidential candidates of both parties had sweeping plans to rein in carbon emissions. These periods of awareness come and go. When pressure builds, the industries with the biggest carbon footprints adopt new messaging, and then the pressure dissipates, and life and heating goes on. While Staples' announcement is significant, it also fits neatly into that unfortunate pattern, which is especially galling because the industry he represents has known what's going on for years. Thanks to dogged reporting by Inside Climate News and the Los Angeles Times, we know that as early as 1977, Texas oil giant Exxon, a prominent member of TXOGA, was not only producing its own scientific climate models that calculated future warming trends, but also using that knowledge to plan its long-term investments. The next year, Exxon's chief scientist warned internally that present thinking holds that man has a time window of 5 to 10 years before the need for hard decisions regarding changes in energy strategies might become critical. Yet for decades more, the company funded campaigns to muddy the waters and forestall political action, decisions that have not only spawned a wave of lawsuits against Exxon, but also transformed the very physical and chemical compositions of the atmosphere. In light of this history, it might seem as if nothing will ever change, at least not in time to stave off the grimmest future scenarios predicted by scientists. But that's too pessimistic a view. There are reasons for hope, and none of them comes from a most, and one of them comes from a most unexpected source, young Republicans. Benji Backer is a clean-cut, wholesome-looking Wisconsin conservative who cut his teeth arguing with teachers in high school about Republican Governor Scott Walker's fight with public unions. But now at the age of 22, he's the president and founder of the American Conservation Coalition, which is trying to sell the Republican Party on environmental issues. The group draws inspiration from the legacy of Teddy Roosevelt and Richard Nixon, who championed national parks and oversaw the creation of the EPA, respectively. Backer knows something that both Staples and Crenshaw alluded to in their remarks. On climate change, young Republicans are closer to Democrats in many ways than older Republicans. A pivotal moment in Backer's political awakening came when he attended the Conservative Political Action Conference, at the time an important annual gathering of movement conservatives. There he connected with other young conservatives who, he learned, considered traditional social issues like gay marriage to be irrelevant. Instead, Backer says, the activists want to talk about climate change, a number one issue throughout their entire lives. Public opinion surveys bear this out. In October, the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas revealed a stark generational gap among Republicans on the issue of climate. Only 33% of Texas Republicans over 40 said they thought climate change was happening, compared to a whopping 70% of those under 40. Of those young Republicans who believe it is happening, 61% said they're very or somewhat worried. Those under 40 Republicans are even more likely to be very worried about climate change than independents of all ages. Such surveys may actually undersell generational differences. As one conservative pointed out to me, young Republicans over the age of 30 or so grew up during the culture wars of the 2000s and developed a distaste for environmentalists, exemplified by Al Gore and the South Park character Man Bear Pig, a cartoon reflection of the popular view that people who talked about climate change were smug, hypocritical weirdos. Young Republicans like Backer don't see things that way. Even within young Republican groups, Backer says, the gap between younger and older members can be cavernous. American Conservation Coalition, it should be said, is not influential, at least not yet. Other conservatives have mocked the group, and only a few elected officials have endorsed its mission, mostly Republicans from the Northeast and the Pacific Northwest. But Backer and his peers stress to other Republicans that climate change policy can be a bridge to a younger generation that generally views the party with disdain. And they warn their elders that they'll be forced to align with Democrats if the GOP refuses to move on an issue that some young Republicans feel is existential. Republicans will keep losing a youth vote if they don't rethink this, Backer says. Backer's group isn't alone. Students for Carbon Dividends is a confederation of college Republican clubs that supports the idea of imposing a price on carbon and returning the proceeds to Americans in the form of a tax rebate. Its founding coalition included college Republican and young conservative chapters at Texas Christian University, Trinity University in San Antonio, and the University of Houston. Though the news media focuses on left-wing climate activists, these conservatives might have more of an influence on the climate debate, polarized as it is. But as they know, they are running out of time to make a mark. So that kind of conveniently brings us to the end of our reading for today. You've been listening to Texas Monthly Magazine, Saturday afternoons at 5 and Monday afternoons at 2, on Sight into Sound Broadcasting, your print information source.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Texas Gardening, followed by audiobook news at 4:30.
Coronavirus Briefs.
The Midland Community Health Care Services on Monday detailed that, per guidance from the CDC, that all Midland clinics must utilize social distancing. There will be no walk-in patients or unscheduled visits to any of the clinics. All must have an appointment.
Saturday and Sunday mornings, enjoy a variety of religious publications and features. Saturdays at 7 a.m., it's Guidepost Magazine, followed at 8 a.m. with the week's Sunday school lessons. Those are repeated Sundays beginning at 4 a.m. Then Sunday mornings at 6, it's Catholic Today, and at 7, Christianity Today. On Recording Library of West Texas Radio, read by listening.
Only the lonely know the way I feel. Doing. but only the lonely know why I cry. Only the lonely
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 81 and partly cloudy. Tonight, clear with a low in the upper 40s. Then, tomorrow, sunny with a high in the mid-80s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 4 p.m.
Hello, and welcome to our program. My name is Janet Roberts, and I will be reading The Texas Gardener here on Sight Into Sound Radio. From The Texas Gardener, White in the Garden by Dr. William C. Welch, continued. Few plants are tougher than the Henry Dulberg salvia that thrives in Texas heat and blooms spikes of blue flowers from late spring through fall. A sometimes overlooked beauty is the white flowering form of Augusta Dulberg. While heat and drought tolerant, they perform best when cut back mid to late summer, which stimulates a beautiful fall display. Small flowering trees can be another opportunity to bring white into the garden. Crepe myrtles come in dwarf and full-size white forms. Flowering dogwood is one of our most beautiful native trees, but only thrives in acidic, well-drained soil. The layer effect of the branching and floral display adds a beautiful touch to any garden. White forms of redbud and Mexican plums add short seasons of color, as well as decorating trunks and stems to our gardens. Natchez crepe myrtles have beautiful peeling bark revealing cinnamon-colored trunks. Severely pruning crepe myrtles results in destroying their natural form, so it is best to only remove crossing limbs and spent flowers. Beware of overpruning, which may result in crepe murder. I hope this survey serves as an inspiration for incorporating white into your own garden while making it a more beautiful and meaningful space for you and your family. From The Texas Gardener, Springtime Means Azalea Time by Keith Hansen. I live in the northeastern part of Texas where pine trees grow like weeds thanks to the acidic soil and high annual rainfall. This combination makes it possible to easily grow a wide range of different kinds of plants that thrive in these conditions, especially azaleas. Starting this month, azaleas become shining beacons of color at home and commercial landscapes all across East Texas. Tyler, where I live, is home to the Tyler Azalea Trails, which draw tens of thousands of visitors every year to tour the miles of brick and paved streets where azaleas grow and bloom in abundance. This year will be the 60th annual event, and it is always worth a trip. However, Tyler is not the only place to see azaleas in abundance. The River Oaks Garden Club in Houston has been featuring an azalea trail for 85 years, which includes tours of the Bayou Bend home and garden, along with other homes and gardens in the area. A relative newcomer to the azalea trail world is located in Nacogdoches, the oldest town in Texas. 2000 marks the first year the Nacogdoches Convention and Visitors Bureau and the Flora Garden Club established the Nacogdoches Azalea Trail with 25 miles of trails through the historical town. But what sets this display apart is the amazing and enormous azalea collection featured in the SFA Gardens on the campus of Stephen F. Austin State University. What began as a vision by Dr. Dave Creech and a graduate thesis project in 1997 has resulted in a first-class garden. What was once a privet-infested bottomland loblolly forest periodically inundated with floodwater from Lanana Creek is now the largest azalea garden in Texas with more than 7,000 azalea bushes along with Japanese maple, dogwood, and camellia companions nearby. Barbara Stump was the graduate student tasked with designing an 8-acre azalea garden for her MA thesis when Dottie Wisely stepped in and provided an endowment to actually create the designed garden. The result is the Ruby M. Mize Azalea Garden, which was dedicated in 2000 and completed in 2002. There are 46 beds filled with azaleas, camellias, Japanese maples, and many other special plants, accessed by more than a mile of easily traveled paved walkways. Many benches are available for sitting when one may pause to reflect and enjoy the overpowering beauty of so many azaleas of every kind and color. There are more than 550 different kinds of azaleas, 100 varieties of camellias blooming from fall through early spring, and special collections of hydrangeas, boxwoods, Japanese plum yew, and other rare and interesting plants. Also interspersed throughout are hundreds of Japanese maple varieties that compete with the azaleas with their beautiful new spring foliage. Then, in late fall, about the end of November, the Ruby M. Mize garden is transformed in another blaze of color as the Japanese maple put on their end-of-year fall display with yellow, oranges, reds, and purples. Don't think you can tour this garden in half an hour when it is in full bloom during March and April. The winding trails take you through vista upon vista of masses of azaleas in an array of colors and delightful color combinations, making every bend in the trails a Kodak moment. You'll feel like you've left the busy world behind and are immersed in the beauty of nature, surrounded by a spectrum of soft and hot pinks, oranges, yellows, purples, reds, whites, and color blends blooming under the towering canopy of pines and southern sugar maples. The large sweeping beds are organized by azalea hybrid groups, where masses of representative cultivars of each type show you their potential impact if similarly used in your own landscape. You'll find a collection of the rare Hang azalea varieties, which were bred in China and brought to the U.S. a mere 40 years ago. There are the groups of early blooming azaleas like the Karoom and Southern Indica hybrids. These will be followed a few weeks later by the mid-season spring bloomers like Robin Hill, Girard, Carla, and Glendale hybrids. Later in May, you'll find the striking Satsuki hybrids. Satsuki means fifth month in Japanese, with a spectrum of hues, sometimes with unusual random patterns of mixed colors in a single bloom. And then there are the taller, growing deciduous azaleas native of North America, sporting fragrant honeysuckle-shaped blooms before the leaves cover the upright branches. Depending on the species or hybrid, their flower color ranges from pale to medium pink, yellow, a color not represented by the Asian evergreen azaleas, tangerine orange, and brilliant red. These are also represented by their hybrid groups, such as the Aromi and Confederate series. Guided tours are available for groups through the garden during the Azalea Trail, and the Ruby M. Mize Garden hosts other events, including a Little Princess Tea Party and an annual Azalea Symposium. In 2011, azaleas in the SFA Gardens expanded with the creation of the Gala Mize Garden right across from University Drive from the Ruby M. Mize Azalea Garden. SFA graduate Ray Mize urged David Creech, SFA Garden Director, to turn this area into a beautiful garden. Originally called the SFA Recreational Trails and Gardens, it was renamed in honor of Gala Mize, a long-term supporter of Nacogdoches Beautiful and the SFA Gardens. This 8-acre garden continues the tradition of bringing unique, new, or underused, unknown plants to trial and display. Since the Ruby M. Mize Azalea Garden mainly, but not solely, features evergreen azaleas native to Asia, the emphasis in the Gala Mize Garden will be on the distinctive and beautiful azaleas and their hybrids native to the U.S. These azaleas are deciduous, losing their leaves in the winter and bursting forth with brilliant and fragrant honeysuckle-shaped flowers in the springtime, often before the leaves emerge. Their growth habit, unlike the mounding evergreen azaleas, are upright, letting them shine above lower-growing plants. And the flower colors range from pink to flaming red to brilliant golden yellow and blends of all the foregoing colors. In addition to azaleas, the Gala Mize Garden also displays other collections, including crinums, camellias, and a variety of other unique, rare, and special plants. While visiting, don't miss the labyrinth surrounded by a ring of slender silhouette sweet gum trees. Driving down University Drive in the spring, you do not want to miss these two gardens when their signature azalea, Koromo Shibuku, is blooming. They line both sides of University Drive for more than 800 feet. This unique azalea has spider-like light purple petals and was selected because it is close to FSA's school color. If you are planning a visit to Nacogdoches to see these two azalea gardens, check with the Nacogdoches Visitor Bureau. See timing for the prime bloom period varies from year to year depending on the weather, but in general, mid-March through early April,